Hi, this is John McEwen with Richard Melnick today on syndicatednews.net, talking about his new book, which is called Parents Who Don't Do Dishes. Richard, where are you calling from?
I'm in Crested Butte, John, and thanks so much for having me on your show. Crested Butte, Colorado, that is.
That's a good thing to throw in there. Some people don't know where that huge town is.
Isn't that true?
So you raised a couple of boys up in Crested Butte.
Well, it's still a work in progress. My boys are 15 and 18, although my eldest is off to college now. And, Crested Butte has been an extraordinary place to bring up kids. It's really a fantastic community where everybody looks after everybody else's kids. And whatever success I've had as a parent has been in a large part due to the great environment that they've grown up in.
What made you want to write a book about being a single father, basically?
I guess the genesis, the beginning of the book, goes back to when I was sick with cancer maybe 13 years ago. And my boys were little at the time. They were 3 and 5 years old. And I felt a sense of urgency to teach them life lessons early on because I was afraid of my life being taken away from me. And there was a song, I think it was a Graham Parsons song, where he sang that lyric. So, yeah, once you've looked into that abyss, things definitely change for you. And so at the time, you know, I tried to teach them some skills along the lines of learning to live in the moment, I guess, and being willing to feel the truth of whatever their being was at that time. And then also to have a strong work ethic to ensure their survival.
Well,
so,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just going to say, so the idea of the book was to just sort of reflect on my parenting style, I guess, because of that experience. And now my boys my eldest just finished high school. And so I thought it was a good time to maybe memorialize and reflect back.
One of the things that I enjoyed about your book is teaching them that they can be nice to each other. They don't have to fight.
Well, one of the things I tried to bring out was that it's not to their benefit to fight with each other. And just try and get them to be aware of what the truth of the moment is. And there's a chapter that really delves into that, and I think it's done in a lighthearted way. And so the question I would ask is, well, how is it to your benefit for your brother to have a festering, brooding resentment towards you? And, you know, also ask them to be aware of the truth of the matter and how they were perpetuating the conflict and to give up their need to be right or to be heard or to be understood and basically not be a victim and not be a victimizer. And so I just feel like you can't be one without being the other, and I just want them to see that when they were little. And they concluded that it wasn't to their benefit, and maybe it helped them learn to manage their reactivity a little better.
From what I've read in the book, it seems like you have done a good job of teaching your boys responsibility at a young age.
Well, I think I'm a better writer than I am a parent. But I certainly did my best to teach them that, to practice gratitude and service and be introspective and just to consider that they're part of a larger genus and not just run amok.
I've raised 5 boys, and one of the best decisions that their mother and I agreed upon when we weren't together anymore, as you may know, as anybody may know, times can be hard to agree on things. But when it came to the kids, there was things that we would talk about, and you handled that very well from what I've read in your book. And like one of the ways it manifested for me was agreeing that the kids can do their own laundry. 10 years old, they know how to run the machine, and that way they don't have to, because with 5 boys, that's not my shirt, and why did my shirt turn pink, and where
right.
are my socks, and he took my socks. Well, if they do their own, they do their own laundry, and they'll get it done, and they'll keep track of it. And you did things like that. What did you do that was like that, that you feel like is in the book that tells kids that they are making their own way?
As a parent, you just have to keep a healthy boundary around what works for you. And I know I hate it when my stuff gets commingled with their stuff and I lose a shirt. And of course, now we're all kind of the same size. And actually, they're bigger than me now. That period has sort of passed. But, where my stuff would get lost. And so I would not do their laundry, and I would just do my own. And if they wanted to have clean clothes, well, they certainly know how to work the washing machine and the dryer. I mean, they're dexterous. They've got the skills, and so you can teach them that. If they can play a video game at age 6, they can certainly operate the washing machine.
Yeah, and it really gives them a sense of responsibility of contributing. I always tried to tell my boys, you know, these World War II movies we see, well, the crew is 17 to 19 years old, and the pilots are 21. And Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein when she was 17. So you're 14 now. What are you doing?
Well, exactly. And it must have been intimidating to some degree for your kids to, you know, have such an accomplished artist as a dad. Did that present problems for them?
No, it was usually judged on the quality of the backstage food. Like, that, this must not be a very good gig. The food's cold. It's the business of being in music is a very time-consuming, travel-involved situation where they saw what the work was. They saw that there was an hour and a half or 2 hours when I would go play. They also saw the other 22 hours that would lead up to that.
So have none of your kids have gone into the arts?
Two of them have made quite a few achievements in the music business. One is 36, and that's Jonathan. He's got several albums. And Nathan, at 32, has put out 4 of his own albums. And they're both out there working it hard.
Nice.
And
you must be awfully proud of them.
I'm really glad they're happy doing what they're doing. And your kids seem to be happy. And one thing is, you'd let them do things like cook.
Well, it's true. And it's not just that I let them do things. I actively encouraged them to learn how to cook when they were little, and this was just another way to teach them independence. And also, I thought that was an opportunity for them to help contribute to the juggernaut of our household.
And it gives them something that, when they're older, they'll certainly remember the time when they learned it.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think that the act of cooking also is a great way to learn how to practice, you know, some of those other life skills I was talking about at the beginning of our show, where you learn how to practice immediacy and really be hyper alert to what's happening right now. And so if you're there with the food and you're paying close attention to that grilled cheese sandwich and know just the right time to flip it, well, then you're learning timing and sensitivity and participating in the moment in a deep way. And then, of course, again, as I said, you're contributing to the well-being of the household if you can learn how to cook or do the dishes. And
you might make a sandwich for the other person that's standing there watching you.
Well, yeah, that's the whole idea. And
yeah.
My attitude is that the kids should, being a single dad, I felt like the kids should contribute in a meaningful way. And if you can't pay the mortgage, well, there's other things that you can do, and I can teach you how to cook, or I can teach you how to vacuum or do other things. And it turns out that if kids are praised for their participation, they enjoy it, and they don't mind doing and I don't even think of them as chores. I think of it more as tribute and participation.
Well, in your chapter, Life Isn't Fair, it seems like you cover that a bit, that it's up to their responsibility. What about that chapter?
What I talk about in that chapter a fair amount is not being a victim, not expecting that life should be free from disturbance, really giving that fantasy up, and somehow learning to develop a playful relationship with whatever life brings next. It might be a happy moment, it might be a sad moment, but just being willing to participate in the truth of whatever it might be. I think that's where your liberation comes from. One of my teachers was a woman. She wrote a book called Guide Lectures for Self-Transformation. Her name was Eva Perakos. And she said very elegantly and simply that you just can't be willing, or you just can't selectively feel the fun stuff. And the degree to which you're willing to feel pain is the same degree to which you're able to feel pleasure. And so, yeah, life isn't fair, and you might be something that shows up that's super disturbing. But what you have control over, and what I wanted my boys to learn, is how you react to that. And so the trick is to learn to be willing to feel deeply, pain or pleasure, like Eva said, but then to be able to manage your reactivity around that. Be willing to feel and still, you know, be a good citizen, as it were. And so to that end, it's life isn't fair is the chapter title. And it sort of circles back to what I was talking about when my kids were little, and that is to not be a victim, not feel like a victim, or be a victimizer. And again, the idea is that if ever you feel like a victim, the wise perspective would be to look how you are being a victimizer elsewhere, either in this exact situation, in this relationship with that person that you're having conflict with, or maybe in some other relationship that you're expressing it in a maybe even an unconscious way.
I like the chapter on conscious language because using different words is sometimes so important. Why would you not use the word need and should and trying?
I think that words have energetic meanings to them and overtones. And I think that words like need and should, they presume to know what the other person, how they should feel or, you know, what they need to do. And essentially, I guess the short answer to the question is it's a violation of other sovereignty if you assume to know what they should do or need to think. And, I mean, that was the grand bargain that I struck in my book, Parents Who Don't Do Dishes. And that's that parents practice radical sovereignty. They recognize their kids' right to be who they are and think what they think and craft their life in alignment with their own divine imprint. And in return, the kids offer service. They participate and help around the house. And so if you use language that's unconscious, like, oh, well, you need to do this or you should do that, then it's a violation of the other's sovereignty. And instead of saying something like, well, you need to do the dishes, you could say, I'd appreciate it if you do the dishes, or I love it when you do the dishes, or if you don't, if it's that important to you, you could provide a consequence. You could cheerfully say, well, if you're not willing to do the dishes now, then you can forget about me taking you and your friend swimming this afternoon.
I did things like, who wants to go skiing? And they'd all raise their hand.
Right. Okay.
As soon as I get the house cleaned up and the dishes done, well, I'll be able to take you. If you want to help, we'll be able to ski longer.
Well, exactly. And you were enlightened, John. I mean, you definitely, I'm sure you didn't boss your kids around or bully them. And I just feel that if you take it down to the grain of language and eliminate some of these charged words, then you're going to get a better response.
It's hard to say there's any clear-cut definition of what to do or not do. Like, you can't leave your bed unmade because you'll feel better when it comes back, but I'll feel better. And if somebody comes by, anyway, so what would happen was they'd make their beds and sleep on the floor.
I love it. That is hilarious.
They wouldn't sleep in the stupid bed. They'd sleep on the couch, and then they put the blanket away, or they'd sleep on the floor next to the bed.
That is priceless. I love it. But guess what? You respected their sovereignty, and was there a consequence if they didn't make the bed?
They wouldn't leave, you know. I mean, it would be like, you're not going to go somewhere. The thing is, I made my bed.
Right.
You know, look, I had time to make my bed, and I'm the one driving you to school. I think you can work it out.
Right. And how often did they sleep on the floor, to your knowledge?
It was probably about a third of the time.
My goodness, that's hilarious.
But that was okay, you know, that was fine.
Yeah, well, you kept a good boundary around what worked for you, and they figured out a solution, and everybody's happy.
Well, I think that the book, we're talking with Richard Melnick, who just put out a book called Parents Who Don't Do Dishes and Other Recipes for Life. And what that refers to is his sons, well, they became their own chefs or the family chef. We're talking with Richard Melnick on syndicatednews.net about his new book, Parents Who Don't Do Dishes and Other Recipes for Life. Richard, did your boys both make dinner? Richard, did both of your kids cook?
My youngest son took to the kitchen more so than my elder son. But they both definitely learned how to cook. And they would mostly be responsible for breakfast and lunches, and I would pull together dinner. But we all learned to participate in the well-being of the family, be it cooking or cleaning.
Yeah, that's so important because my mom did everything, and then I got married right after I left the house. And then when I was on my own, one time I was fixing lasagna for the boys, and the five-year-old said, Dad, you're supposed to cook the noodles first. I said, well, they're in there cooking. So you're supposed to boil them first. I said, well, I don't know. They're in there cooking. And this lasagna came out hard as a brick. So I had to tear it apart and boil the noodles and put it back together. I didn't have a clue.
And your five-year-old had it all figured out.
Yeah, because he'd watched his mom. So I put it back together, and it kind of looked like a placenta when it came out. And they said, what's that? I said, it's Mexican pizza. If I hadn't thought of that, they wouldn't have touched it.
Right.
But it's such a good thing to teach the kids how to cook, because as soon as they leave the house, it sure is good to know.
Well, not only that, it's good for them to be able to cook you a nice meal as well. If you're busy, you're traveling, you're skiing, you're doing this or that, why not let them have the responsibility and the joy of providing for others?
Richard, I had a couple of boys that loved cooking, and they got into it. I wish I'd read your book, because I would have helped promote that idea more. I was just occasionally relieved that they fixed food. One of them became an executive chef.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, what a shock to me. And I just think that your book is, there's that one chapter, Shut the Blank Up, that's interesting. I don't want to say the word, but what do you have that chapter that's kind of shocked when you see the F word and you're referring to raising children?
How do
you explain that?
Well, this chapter is, again, part of the grand bargain that I outline, where you respect your kids' sovereignty and manage your own reactivity. And part of that is learning to shut the F up. And the reason that I included this chapter is because I felt like it was only this kind of vulgarity that adequately speaks to the obscene practice of bossing your kid around, as if you know what they need to do or should think. And I knew that it would offend some kindly readers, but I felt that it was something of a litmus test, that if you didn't see any wisdom in my salty suggestion, then maybe it was written justly for you. And it came out of a conversation that I was having with my friend Robin Cox. And Robin played a big part in crafting this book, or she's at least a central character in the book, because about 9 months ago, I was sitting in my kitchen one day talking to her about herself and her 10-year-old boys. And Robin was saying how she's just, they're not helping out around the house the way she'd like. She's nagging them. She's always asking them to do something, and they're not listening. And so during the course of that conversation, I suggested that she wasn't having proper boundaries for herself. She wasn't doing a good job of managing her reactivity. She should instill a consequence instead in order to model craft the behavior that she was looking for from her kids. And so during the course of this conversation, we were talking about encouraging service around the house and managing reactivity and respecting the kids' sovereignty. Offering compassion and empathy without needing to fix anything, and of course conscious language too. And I told Robin that her kids were experiencing her as, well, I told her that she needed to shut the F up, essentially. And it was, and I offered it cheerfully, and I said it to her, she's my dear sweet friend, and I said it to her in order to add emphasis to my petition. And she was upset with me. I mean, no doubt. She was offended. But then she called me back a couple days later, and she said, I've had my epiphany. I have changed the way I do things. I've changed the way I say things. I'm managing my reactivity. And she witnessed, and I think this is the best line in the book, and it's her words, she witnessed what she called the beauty of the death of control. And so I decided to include that phrase in this chapter title and to talk around it, and directly as well, about it, because I just felt like the readers needed to be shocked like Robin was in order to take accountability and examine their own behavior and how am I micromanaging my kid and am I really doing them a favor? Am I really teaching them to be creative and in their own life flow and take responsibility for their life? Or am I caught up in some kind of neurotic web of codependency with my kid? And so anyway, that's why I included that phrase. And, of course, I also, not of course, but I did include an example of myself not having taken my own advice and what the consequences of my own actions were for not managing my reactivity with my own boys. And, it's not pretty.
I think one of the things that happens with parents that I see is they don't want to lose control. They only have one thing in their life that they feel like they really can control or should have the right to be totally the boss. When they get home, you're going to do this and you're going to do that. Well, it's not control is the word the parent should be thinking of as much as influence and guidance.
Right.
And,
I couldn't agree more. And the paradox is if you offer up your suggestions respectfully, I think it would be to your benefit to blah, blah, blah. If you offer up your suggestions respectively, they're more likely to listen. At least that's been my experience. Do you think there's some truth to that?
Yes, and that's why I enjoyed reading Parents Who Don't Do Dishes. We're talking with Richard Melnick on Syndicated News, who, being a single father raising two boys, is, and as you say, it's an ongoing situation. And my kids are 32 through 42, and I'll tell you, it continues to be ongoing.
Well, that would be my expectation, too. And in a sense, I feel like they're raising me as well, because I feel like the whole project of having kids has just been a great opportunity for me to see how I roll and to grow a little bit as a person.
And do your kids understand the phrase, pardon?
I know, I was going to ask you if you found that to be the same, but I guess you can't separate yourself from your experiment because you have had kids and you have grown over all these years, and who's to say what's the cause? But I know that I feel like a different person, you know, before and after having kids.
And then, on the other hand, it's really fun when the kids express things like Mark Twain said, you know, the famous Mark Twain line, when I was 17, I was astonished at how much he'd learned in 4 years.
Exactly.
And it's like...
I know, that's such a classic. I love that. I'd forgotten the punchline. Thank you.
All right. Well, good luck with it. I think it's some good words that people with kids, especially if you're a single parent, I think, you know, whether you're the single mother or the single father, sometimes you're not going to call the ex necessarily for advice, and you like to try and agree on things. This book can help guide some people to a way to smooth that out, I think.
Well, thank you, John. It's been interesting. Because of the cover of the book, it's painted by a local artist here in Crested Butte named Kate Seeley. It's kind of a magical, dreamy picture of a sink full of dishes. And so I'm often asked if it's a children's book because of the cover. And, you know, I stop, but I have to also say kind of yes, because it happens that a bunch of my kids' friends have been reading the book, and they have really been enjoying it. And so that's just been a great thrill for me to find that to be.
Well, maybe somebody will make it a Christmas present.
Well, that would be great. Hi, I'm Richard Melnick. I'm the author of Parents Who Don't Do Dishes, and you can find it right here on syndicatednews.net.